How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Glad
to hear
it.
By the time this airs, it will be Thanksgiving.
Good.
For the United States, anyway.
Yes, I'm ready. It is my favorite meal of all time. So, just going
to
say
I'm ready
that.
To see some family members. I'm excited.
Well, yeah,
but other than that, that's it.
I'm not going to ask who.
What case are you going to give us today that takes us into our turkey day?
Well, this is from our good friend Chrissy with the K.
Yay, here. Chris.
We're going back in time a little bit. And so we're ready to go. You ready to go?
Gonna go back in time. Yep. Let's go.
It's Saturday morning and you're getting ready to go grocery shopping, get it all done for the week. As you stand in, and we've all done this, you know you have. As you stand in the checkout line, you're waiting for your turn. You glance over to the expertly placed magazines and it draws your attention in immediately. You see the headlines, body parts found in a trunk after being unloaded from the train in Los Angeles.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun. You're automatically pulled into the headline and you begin reading the salacious details about a cold-blooded murderer, a butcher, a woman out of her mind.
A woman?
Or a woman out of her mind. Or was she? Dun, dun, dun. The headlines we hear about today often, you know, hit social media within minutes of the event happening, and the news media closely follows behind with headlines that blare across the evening news. In today's high-profile crime cases, these cases often are tried in the court of public opinion.
Always tried, usually, yes.
Before they even hit the courtroom. In Winnie Ruth Judd's case, those same opinions were discussed almost immediately after Judd bought a ticket, boarded a train with body-filled trunks, and headed for Los Angeles. Now, these are the trunks that, you know, you would, I was like steamer trunks.
Travel trunks, yeah.
Travel trunks.
Mm-hmm. Some people actually have them as coffee tables now.
They do. En route, the trunks began to leak, emit a horrible smell. Police were there, ready for her, and they greeted Judd at the Los Angeles station and asked her to open the trunks. Winnie was afraid and mortified on the inside, but her outward demeanor was coy and standoffish. When asked to smell the trunks, she leaned in and claimed, she couldn't smell anything at all. Smells just fine.
Haven't we all done that?
Mm-hmm. The baggage attendants pushed her to open the trunks, thinking that it was possibly a deer was killed or some sort of animal and it was being transported, perhaps illegally or perhaps for meal purposes. Different time, Jen. Claiming that her husband had the keys, she fled the scene. She didn't just escape, Jen. She masterfully fashioned a story that would allow her to walk away with her brother, who was waiting for her. They drove off and never returned for the luggage. It's noted that Winnie's brother, Burton, knew nothing about what had happened a few days before and had zero clue of what was inside the trunks or even the hat box that would be found later on in the train station's bathroom. The trunks were forced open, and inside there would be dismembered bodies. There was also a tattered brown suitcase and a hat box left in that bathroom, and they both had more body parts in them. This all occurred on October 16th, 1931.
That's your birthday.
It is my birthday.
You're two.
I was not born yet, Jen, and I hate you for that. It was a bloody Friday night in Phoenix, Arizona. The famous duplex would become the murder house. It's a quiet neighborhood in a small town where Winnie, along with two of her friends, were gathered at the friend's small duplex to hang out and enjoy girls' night. What happened next became an enduring and sensationalized part of history. An argument would break out between the friends, and it's still unclear exactly what that argument was about. Was it about Jack Halloran? Was it about money? Or perhaps even other women? A gun appeared, and Agnes Ann Leroy and Hedvig Sammy Samuelson died. The body of Agnes was jammed into a large trunk, while Sammy Samuelson's body was too heavy and would not fit. Her body was then dissected, placed into multiple suitcases, and covered by articles of clothing. If that's going to keep the stench out, I don't think so. Or the blood, for that matter. Setting the scene for the story is very important because Arizona was not just some dry, hot desert city at the time. It was a bustling metropolis with large amounts of money pouring in from the wealthy. People like Chicago's chewing gum magnate, William Wrigley Jr. Wrigley had already invested $2 million into a building called the Arizona Biltmore Hotel, and that hotel would attract movie stars and kings. Wrigley liked Arizona so much that he built a lavish home next to the hotel, known as the Wrigley Mansion. Politicians were in power and the wealthy were running the town. A woman's place was at home, but a woman of the night, wink, wink, sat among the rich doctors, lawyers, and politicians. Their quaint, low-rent apartments were being afforded by the men, and a small stipend, along with a few necessities, were given as gifts to either keep them quiet or keep them happy enough to continue the arrangement that they had with the men, keeping them busy when the men were not with them and were...
Pretty much nothing has changed, is what... It's always been like it is. Yeah.
There you go. That's the truth. Not a lot changes.
Just life wasn't as spoke about as, yeah, as it is spoken today. About. Yeah.
Life revolved around family and home and a strict moral code that said a man was required to be faithful and productive for his family. A woman was to raise her children, to be God-fearing and successful. And the kids were to stay out of trouble, you know, seen and not heard kind of thing. Divorce was the most horrible admission that someone wasn't following the script. And playing around was scandalous. This crime, with its deceit and jealousy, is heavily laden with plenty of scandals. Dun, dun. It was a scandalous love affair between two women, sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis, which in that time was such a hidden secret that the mere mention could ruin a person's reputation and livelihood. A wealthy playboy named Jack, Happy Jack, Halloran was at the center of this devious crime that took place on that bloody Friday night. All the pieces came together that bloody night when a huge fight started between Annie and Winnie, apparently over introducing Jack to a woman who had syphilis the night before on Thursday, October 15th. The introduction was only meant to be friendly, informational talk about deer hunting sites nearby. Winnie had met Lucille Moore at the medical clinic in which she worked, the Grinnell Clinic, where she was a medical receptionist. Also, the same place where her friend Anne worked as an X-ray technician. Winnie made arrangements for Jack to pick up Lucille along with Winnie to discuss the White Mountains deer hunting sites. Wonder if that's code for what they're really talking about, or if they really are talking about hunting sites.
I don't know.
I don't know.
We'll never know.
We won't. After her arrest, Winnie later tells the sheriff that Halloran was already drunk when he called her at the clinic to discuss a time to pick her up. At 7 p.m., he shows up at Winnie's work and heads over to pick up Lucille. They head back to Winnie's apartment, but Jack wants to stop and see Anne and Sammy first. Winnie did not want to go by Anne's home and made Jack promise not to let them know she was waiting in the car. Winnie was hesitant to let them know that she had introduced Lucille to Jack, presumably because she had syphilis and Jack supported Anne and Sammy financially. It can only be assumed that there would be extreme jealousy and disdain over her, as well as the, you know, STD she had, or STI, as I think they call them today. Technically. It didn't go as planned, of course. Anne and Sammy saw Winnie and Lucille sitting in the car. Anne invited them all in for dinner with two men she had met earlier. Mm. Winnie declined, and as Jack came back out with two men in tow, they all climbed into Jack's car and headed to Winnie's for some conversation and liquor. Mm-mm. These details were all given by Winnie after her arrest. The information she gave to police was disorganized and confusing. Winnie was emotionally and mentally confused about all of the events that had taken place that night. Now, before we get to the events of Friday, October 16th, there's still much to be covered about Winnie Ruth Judd and her life. The story contains lots of speculation about what happened on that fateful night. To understand Winnie better, one must examine her childhood, adulthood, and those around her to determine if she could shoot, kill, dismember, and attempt to dispose of evidence, all while acting alone. Winnie Ruth Judd does admit she shot the women over a heated argument on that Friday night. Winnie claims that they were all three getting along just fine, and a conversation came up about the woman from the night before. Anger and tempers flared. Anne and Winnie started throwing accusations back and forth and threatening to expose each other about the dark secrets in their lives. Sammy, at some point, came at Winnie with a gun, and a struggle ensued. The gun went off, and a bullet tore through Winnie's hand.
So Winnie was shot?
So yeah, Jen, the gun was fired, but you see, it was all in self-defense. So that is what Winnie would claim anyway. The statements and facts from the crime scene backed up Winnie's story and made it all plausible. There we go. End of story. Nope, not really. Of course not. Except for a few significant details, such as how the bodies got stuffed into a steamer trunk. How did another body get dismembered and scattered between a trunk, hatbox, and suitcase? We'll get back to that in a minute, Jen. Let's talk a little bit more about other things going on. At this point in time, there was, shall we say, an ugly underbelly of that part of town that pretty much everyone from Phoenix ignored. Prostitution was barely a thing, when in actuality, it was a thriving industry. There was no political corruption, except, yeah, it was rampant.
There's always political corruption, especially when there's money involved, like high, big money.
Man and wife meant forever, and neither would even think of straying. Yet, it happened more often than not. It seemed easy to project a public face of strict morals when your town could crow about the 80 churches around town, not much different than some of today's fabrics of society. Winnie Ruth Judd was born in Indiana to a pair of very conservative parents. Her mother was in her middle 30s when she had Winnie, and some complications led to pneumonia at birth. At age 4, Winnie's susceptible and weakened lungs led to a case of tuberculosis. After she married, she would end up in the hot desert of Arizona. She was hoping it would give her lungs a little bit of a break and, you know, allow her to be a little bit more healthy.
People still do that these days, the dry heat without the
humidity. But it's a dry heat.
Remember? Exactly.
But it's a dry heat. Winnie had a younger brother named Burton, and at the time of the murders, he was actually a college student in Los Angeles. Burton and Winnie were very close growing up, and she would often write to him about her different locations to keep him informed about her life. Winnie ended up marrying a doctor named William Judd, whom she met at 18 at a psychiatric hospital in 1923. She was smitten by the 41-year-old doctor who headed one of the units. They met up for casual lunches in the hospital, and eventually William asked her out for dinner that August. Winnie wanted to go out to dinner, but she had promised her minister father to give a speech that night at the church on missionary work. William told her he would go to the church first, listen to her speak, and then take her to dinner. Winnie was elated and wrote in one of her many diary entries that she wore everything new she owned, wanting to impress, and was excited about going out to dinner.
With a doctor.
With a doctor, no less. Winnie and William married on April 18th, 1924. Winnie left home for the first time that night on a honeymoon trip that would mark her first train ride, her first sight of New Orleans, her first day in a hotel. I guess that'd be her first night as well, too. Wink, wink. Her first visit to Mexico. Winnie Ruth Judd's diary entries all recalled it. And it was her sweet memories, her, you know, Mm-hmm. At this point, they were good. Everything was good. Dr. Judd had landed a job in Mexico where he worked as a doctor for the crew at an American-owned silver mine. The 3 years in Mexico would turn out to be the only genuinely happy time the couple ever shared. Winnie Ruth even realized her greatest dream. She became pregnant. But the weather in that part of Mexico had flared her tuberculosis. Dr. Judd knew she was too weak to carry and deliver a child. Winnie lost the baby and would again get pregnant, only to lose the second one as well.
It's heartbreaking.
It is. By the end of 1927, Winnie was so sick that her husband sent her to a sanitarium in California, hoping the treatments would help her TB. She got well enough to go back to Dr. Judd's new post in Dolores, Mexico. But eventually, the climate there didn't agree with her, and she ended up back in the States. At some point, she moved to Arizona because of the warm climate, and Dr. Judd promised to join her, assuring her he could find a job in town. Definitely the town would need doctors, right?
You would think so.
But he never did. While he would come to visit Winnie in Arizona, meet her friends, hang out with her for a while, he never stayed for very long. As time went on and Dr. Judd was unable to hold a job and stay financially stable, it came out that he was addicted to morphine as well as other prescription drugs. Winnie would claim it started because of an injury he sustained while serving in the Army during World War I. Winnie, it turns out, had excuses for his addiction, but was well aware of his drug problems. He could never support her or the marriage. Her heart was broken, but she always held out hope for him. At some point while working in Arizona, Winnie met a man by the name of Jack Halloran. Halloran was 44 years old and was one of the town's success stories. Someone later described him as about as prominent a man as you'd find in Phoenix in those days. That's a good thing to be described as, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Jack was married with 3 children. He was among the movers and shakers in town and knew all the prominent political and social members. His philandering ways were overlooked and hidden because many of the other men in town, oh, yeah, they did the same thing. All of this meant he was untouchable, you know, because if they, you know, somebody tells on him, then he's going to take them out too.
Exactly. That's how that works.
You know how that works. I was just going to say that. Jack likely had enough blackmail material on all the men he ran around with. At Winnie's arrest, nobody was willing to expose Jack, even though he was suspected of participating and covering up the murders. Because of the fact no one would step up and expose Jack, Winnie Ruth Judd was just a woman that could be tossed away. Take the blame, and all would be forgiven. As we go back to the night of the murder on October 16th, it's clear that at some point, Anne and Winnie had talked that day. Winnie planned to meet up with a real estate broker to look for a large enough house for all 3 women, each having separate quarters and entryways, of course. Goodbye. Winnie had been in conversation with her parents and wanted to have them come and stay with her in Arizona. The talks between Anne and Winnie during the day on Friday seemed to be around trying to find a vehicle to borrow so that they could look at homes over the weekend. Sounds like me. Anne, at some point, asked Winnie to come over for dinner and hang out at the duplex that night. Winnie declined because she had plans to meet up with Jack Halloran. Anne was jealous of that ongoing relationship, but Anne and Sammy were known to be a couple, and yet they maintained close relations with some of the most prominent men in town, including Jack. Maybe the relationship was overlooked or not believed because of the intimacy they seemed to carry out with men. Sammy was a sickly woman who was just a friend Anne took care of obsessively. Anne had a good job and was the breadwinner for Sammy and herself. Anne worked at the Grunau Clinic with Winnie, so they both knew many of the same people, and Anne was very friendly with many of the doctors.
Very friendly how, I wonder?
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
At one time, all 3 of the women had lived together. They seemed to get along and had many parties with men in town. At some point, Sammy fell ill and went into a sanatorium for a while. Anne and Winnie got along, but not without some turmoil. Seemingly over petty issues as to how the house was kept, whose turn it was to do what. Typical stuff that you get into it with people you live with. Am I wrong? Am I wrong? Some feel it was because of Anne's jealousy towards Winnie and Jack's relationship. Sammy came back, and the relationship between the three women became strained. Winnie moved to her place, but still maintained a friendship with Ann and Sammy. As Friday night proceeded, Winnie was at her house waiting for Jack to come over. She had no intentions of going over to her friend's house. But as 9:30 approached, Winnie became frustrated that Jack had not yet shown up. Winnie wrote later that she became frustrated and would not spend the weekend alone. She was adamant. She decided to take the last trolley ride to Ann and Sammy's home and arrived close to 10 p.m. The women decided to get in their pajamas and play cards, but an argument broke out between the three. In her final confession to Sheriff John McFadden before her death sentence was to be carried out, Winnie Ruth Judd finally gave a complete but rambling confession as to the most real events that took place that night. McFadden was considered a straight arrow, no nonsense kind of guy who worshipped honesty. McFadden had the best vantage point of all of Arizona officials who touched the Ruth Judd case. Not only has he and his deputies helped the Phoenix police investigate the crime, he had personally spent time with Winnie Judd more than anyone else. Before that final confession, Winnie had endured months of public scrutiny. All the while, she was on the run until October 23rd, when she surrendered herself to authorities, out of all places, a funeral home.
Oh, nice.
Could you imagine being there and being quiet and paying your respects and that happens? During her week on the lam, Winnie hid right under the searching officers' noses. The press was having a field day with the salacious headlines detailing her gruesome murder and whether the facts were actual or not. You know they did. They had to have a heyday with this back in the day. The famous media mogul, William Randolph Hearst, was at the top of the scandalous stories. Hearst was known for his spicy headlines and a need to stylize the story to get the reader's attention. And boy, was he. He was ruthless. Yeah, he was Winnie Ruth Judd ruthless. This story seemed to be his prized possession, and he did everything he could to be at the forefront of all the local and nationwide news outlets. Now, it's essential here to mention that not only did Hearst provide money for Judd's defense, but he was also responsible for her demise. He became fascinated with Winnie Judd and felt sorry for her as he learned the actual story of what had happened. Winnie's story never changed too much from her self-defense claims, which at the time in Phoenix was a non-punishable offense. At the time of Judd's arrest, the authorities got a look at the frail and exhausted Winnie Ruth Judd. She was in a soiled dress and her hair needed washing. Her gaunt face revealed she was not eating well or eating at all. She was on the verge of collapse. Her enormous eyes looked unfocused. Around her shoulders was the comforting arm of a man who seemed too ordinary, too old to be this young beauty's husband. The reporters that had been ravaging her in the week prior were now looking at her in dismay. The first words out of Winnie's mouth would make them realize that this case was not at all what it seemed. She opened her mouth and claimed, "I had to shoot her." She sobbed, then hid her face in her husband's shoulder. An attorney hired by Dr. Judd read her statements, and it goes like this. "I had gone to the girl's home to discuss with Miss Samuelson regarding some nasty things she had said about Miss Leroy. This is the first time that it came out that Anne was married. She was estranged from her husband, but she was married. In fact, Anne had been married 3 times, and Sammy had never been married. It was reported that Sammy was jealous of Anne's marriage and wanted to never talk about, quote, him, end quote, when the women were together. Mrs. Samuelson got a hold of the gun and shot me in the left hand. I struggled with her, and the weapon fell. Mrs. Leroy grabbed an ironing board and started to strike me over the head with it. I got hold of the gun in the struggle, and Sammy got shot. Mrs. Leroy was still coming at me with the ironing board, and I had to shoot her. Then I ran from the place," end quote. Winnie cradled the proof of this dramatic plea of self-evidence in her left hand. As it was purple and swollen, a bullet still embedded already had gangrene. Several witnesses had seen Winnie's bandaged hand before she turned herself in. That part of the crime was left out at trial because the prosecution needed Winnie Ruth Judd not to be injured so that they couldn't use the self-defense claim. Prosecutors knew they were faced with a glitch if she was injured, because how could a small, slight woman shoot her friends and then stuff one in a trunk and dismember the other with an injured left hand? It's a good point, Mr. Prosecutor. I must agree. They had to remove that equation from Winnie and take the story off of Jack Halloran for being an accomplice. The prosecutors claimed that Winnie shot herself in the hand after she committed the gruesome crimes to claim self-defense. But corruption was at play here. Why? Famous, influential men would be exposed.
And it gets be a first.
Different, yes. The night of the murder, witnesses saw Winnie's bandaged hand. Winnie went to work at the clinic on Saturday with a bandaged hand. These facts and witnesses were buried because it would affect the investigation. The truth would have a profound effect on the outcome of the case. There was evidence that Winnie had been in a fight for her life from the pictures taken by a doctor who had examined her hand and the many bruises Mrs. Judd had on her body. The murder house became a tourist attraction almost immediately. The owner of the duplex was charging 10 cents for curiosity seekers. Thousands trampled through the house before police got around to gathering information for their murder investigation. Evidence showed that Halloran had shown up at the duplex the night of the shootings and indeed was most likely the one that stuffed Anne in the trunk and dismembered Sammy. Halloran had found Winnie unconscious on the duplex floor and wanted her to leave the scene. Winnie was distraught and wanted medical help, but Jack talked her out of getting the attention she needed. He told her not to involve the police or tell anyone what had happened.
That tracks. I can see that happening.
Totally. He convinced Winnie to get the trunk and bags taken to the train station. He would take care of everything else. After a lengthy trial and a first-degree murder conviction, Winnie was sentenced to die. Later, the death sentence was commuted and Winnie was put into an insane asylum. Winnie escaped several times, and on one of her escapes, she changed her name and lived a normal life for some time. After being found and taken back to the asylum, she served a few more years and was released. The doctors and district attorney felt that she had done her time. An interesting tidbit of info is that there was a secret about how Winnie escaped the asylum so many times, but was never revealed until the end of her life and the end of this podcast. Halloran was never tried or punished, but it was an unsaid fact that he was guilty. In her final confession, Winnie put more pieces together for McFadden. The shooting's story was always the same, but it revealed the final pieces. Winnie woke up, quote, between two dead bodies on the floor. I ran out of that place. I put my dress on and nothing else, just my shoes and my purse. I went right back to Brill Street to get my pocketbook. I started out the door when Jack Halloran came into the driveway, end quote. Ruth explained that she was going to the Ford Hotel in downtown Phoenix to use the payphone to call her husband in Los Angeles, but there was Jack on her doorstep. We went into the house, and I told him what had happened, and he was dead drunk. He wouldn't believe me. He wanted to go back in the house and make me prove that I was telling the truth. Once we arrived at the duplex, Jack parked the car on Pinot across the street from the duplex. A loud party was going on at the Cunninghams. Mr. Cunningham later testified that he had heard the shots. Jack went into the house and surveyed the situation, seeing the bloody scene. He did something that would forever change the scene. He picked up Sammy and carried her into Anne's bed, blood dripping from her hair. A pool of blood was found in the bedroom corner near the bed, backing up that statement. McFadden remembers the testimony about the blood splatter in different parts of the home and the two mattresses were removed. It became clear to McFadden that Jack had disposed of the evidence. Winnie explains that Jack wanted her to help clean up the blood, but she couldn't because of the wound on her hand. Jack told her he wanted Dr. Brown to take a look at the hand. He owes me lots of favors. Winnie told McFadden, that's what Jack told me.
I'm sure he does.
Lots of them. You know those secrets. Winnie told Jack, no, I want to go to Los Angeles and have my husband remove the bullet. Jack had touched the phone and a set of blinds in the house. The bloodstains were brought up at trial but never tested to determine whose prints they belonged to. Winnie claims that she became hysterical after Jack brought a trunk into the kitchen and put Anne's body into it. Now, could you imagine seeing this unfold?
Oh, no, not at all.
You'd go into shock. Jack drove Winnie home, realizing she was too distraught to help. He told me that he would take care of everything and not to worry. Saturday came, and Jack drove to the clinic to get Winnie and took her back to the duplex and wanted to talk things over. Winnie claimed she was afraid of Jack and felt he would kill her if she didn't take the luggage to Los Angeles with her.
I don't have a doubt in my mind he would.
Winnie asked Jack what he did to the woman, and he stated, "I performed an operation on Sammy." McFadden presses Winnie. He wants her to be more precise on what she saw Jack do to the bodies. Winnie jumps up and starts yelling at McFadden that all I need Jack to do is tell the truth. I shot in self-defense, but he took the bodies and disposed of them. Jack bullied me into going to LA with those trunks. That is why I wanted to testify at my trial. Winnie was hushed at her own trial. McFadden knows that Winnie's confession was given to the judge before the trial, but it was never handed over to the defense. It was deep corruption, and Winnie was silenced at every turn. The evidence led investigators to realize she had to have had help. It didn't matter. Jack Halloran was a prominent figure in Arizona, and the other men that would be exposed for their infidelities needed to be protected. Jack was kind of like the Heidi Fleiss of that day, I'm guessing, but in reverse.
Just a little bit.
Winnie Ruth Judd had a solid self-defense case, but the state would never allow self-defense to play out. There was too much at stake. So she went down as a murderer. Her friends were the part of Phoenix that no one wanted to talk about. Their lives were of no importance, except to the loved ones they left behind. This case would never be exposed, nor what had actually happened. The media tried Winnie Ruth Judd before she ever even got a trial, and the state buried the evidence before she even stepped foot in the courtroom. She never had a chance. A woman caught up in a web of political corruption. Her life was supposed to be happy. She married a doctor so she could be taken care of, which never panned out. She held on to hope that she could find some happiness in her time with Jack Halloran, but he never intended to make her a happy woman. At the end of her life, Winnie Ruth Judd left a package, a gift, if you will, for a dear friend that she trusted. She wanted it opened after her death. Winnie died on October 23, 1998, at the age of 92. She was laid to rest in an unknown place, somewhere secret. There was no funeral, but that doesn't mean she wasn't mourned by those who loved her. The gift was opened by her beloved friend, just as she had wanted, after she had passed away. A note with the quote, "My survival kit," is written on the card. The box was open, and inside was a black lacquer box with tissue paper in it. Upon opening the box, there were a set of keys. Inscribed on the keys was the phrase, "Front door of hospital." Another note was inside the box. The message read that these keys saved my life on many occasions. Some people believed me and wanted me to have the life I deserved. Please keep these keys safe, and if you need to escape, use them as a gift from me. Signed, Marion Lane. Marion Lane was Winnie Ruth Judd's name when she escaped the hospital. She lived under that name for the remainder of her life. That gave me chills a little bit with the keys, I gotta tell you.
And that was the nursing staff from the hospital.
Sad story. Different time, you know?
I know. There's a great book to read from this. I think Chris got a lot of her information from. It's called The Trunk Murderess. Winnie Ruth Judd, The Truth About the American Crime Legend Revealed at Last. The author's by the name of Jana Bommersbach. And she actually found Winnie when she lived in a nursing home. Jana is a journalist, I believe, and went to visit her and found out all the information. It's really an amazing, good book. I strongly suggest, if you're interested in this case, to go read it.
There's a documentary, too, but I couldn't find it.
I wouldn't say it's like a full-fledged documentary. It's like it's an interview with the author, and it kind of goes into the whole situation with the author. It's good. You can find it on YouTube.
I'm going to be doing that this afternoon. Chris, thank you from the bottom.
Thank you, Chris.
Of
it was awesome.
Our podcast hearts. That was interesting. I really like the old cases. I do.
Interesting, because there are, especially in the 20s, because I always, my mind, there's no proven, or not that I found or even looked up, to be honest. 1920s, I always think of Al Capone and the mafia and the big cover-ups, and that's an interesting time for me to research and look into.
You probably don't remember much since you were so little then.
I don't remember anything at all. You would remember more, but from right. what I've heard from your sister, who's younger than you, she tells me all the stuff.
Yeah, right.
But no, right. Anyway, it's a fascinating case, and I strongly suggest that people pick up the book and read it. Poor Winnie. She was just a pawn, and she suffered from it, but the people in the hospital, gave her the keys. I think it's amazing. Amazing.
Oh, it was good. Again, Chris, thank you. Mm. Awesome. Appreciate
it. Awesome, Chris.
So, Jen, have you been watching anything good on the BoobTube?
Keeping up with Dexter. Haven't watched the new one yet. I know you have. I am disappointed because this morning I woke up and Yahoo spoiled my Great British Bake Off for me.
So I'm they did.
So upset.
Why would they do that?
I don't know. I'm upset that it got spoiled. I'm upset by the person that got ousted. I'm upset by the whole thing. That's enraging. I did watch the 2020 show with the Turpin girls.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely heartbreaking. Heartbreaking, those poor kids.
I've said this before. I love words. I love where they come from. I like that all. And I was so, the very first thing I noticed was the way she spoke. And it took a while for Diane Sawyer to get to that. And then I started thinking, I think we do, as children, learn so much from our surroundings. And just the neglect made her speech different. Almost sounded like she had an accent, but it wasn't. And then
it sounded like she was learning English. She was from another country and she was
English,
learning
as
a second. Yes. English was her second language.
You
yes.
just nailed it. You got that. Yep. Mm-hmm. I couldn't think of it, but that's it.
No, they spent no time with her. They didn't know how to read. She didn't
Why would they
know.
Keep having babies to do that? Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I mean, I know they were mentally ill, obviously.
I don't know, but did you see when the police knocked on the door? Did you get a load of the mother's face?
Oh,
when they said that somebody from this house called?
Uh-huh.
Did you see?
Oh, I did. And then later on, she goes, she came back around
bitch.
To it. She came back around to it and goes,
yeah, now who now, is it?
Now who was that? Because, you know, in her head, she's like, which kid is missing? Mm-hmm. Who did this?
Yeah.
I hope they never, I don't know. That just, all those lives ruined. Okay, what else did you watch?
That's it. I'm reading a really good book right now.
What are you reading?
I'm more of a reader than an actual TV watcher. I'm reading the book Sundown Motel by Simone St. James. Mm. It's about a girl whose aunt goes missing in 1982, and it's at this hotel. And so far, they're thinking it might be ghosts. So it's very ghosty, very true crimey.
Simone St. John sounds like a romance novel.
Simone St. James.
Oh, that's even better.
Yes.
Simone St. James. Yeah.
Yes. So she normally writes thrillers and stuff. So supernatural mystery. I've
good
never
for this
read
time
her,
of year.
But she's a New York Times writer. Yeah. Just been reading and trying to write our very last script for the year before our Nightmare Before Christmas comes out. What have you been watching? I know you've been watching everything.
Everything. I woke up at 4:00 this morning, Jen, so I was watching Dexter at that time.
Good.
It's good. I'm not going to say anything else about it. I watched The Curse of Van Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
That is a train wreck. It's kind of like you just sit there with your mouth going, huh, 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 like that. Let's see.
Tiger King?
King? Watch that. Yeah, watch that. I think I might have to rewatch it because you know what? There's so much craziness going on there. I don't even know. Like,
Tiger
all
King,
crazy.
The only reason why I'm going to watch Tiger King 2, I kind of had it, I'm overloaded on Tiger King. But Tiger King 2, I think you've heard me talk about how I watch these search dogs that are on TikTok and I follow them on TikTok. Mm-hmm. They are actually in the Tiger King show.
Oh, so you're supporting them. You're not supporting
them. So I'm supporting them. I'm not supporting
anybody
else.
You never even watched the first one, did you?
I did.
Oh,
I did
watch
the first one.
Because you hated it. Because you couldn't stand that.
He drove me absolutely insane.
They all do, though. They're all like, There's just no words.
I know.
Watch it.
And
we
it
need
got
to talk.
Be too much of a train wreck for me to stomach.
This
I did
just
watch
like
it. I might not have finished the very last part of it.
Mm-hmm.
He's such a tragic.
You
got to
watch The Mad Cusser. Okay. I don't remember him from the first season. He probably was in it because it's been a while, but.
Yeah. The Von Dutch, I started it, but I really wanted to get back into my book.
I
quit it. I just saw how everybody wanted to take claims that they started the company. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be a train wreck too. And then I know Paris Hilton is in there somewhere. So I've got to brace myself for that because she's a celebia turd, in my opinion.
She's, yeah.
I just, there's
I remember
just some
that,
people
though. I remember
that I can't...
all of those celebrities wearing that hat.
Oh, yeah. No, I do too.
Yep.
That's it. Yeah. I started it and I just like, yeah, I can't. I'm not in the mindset to watch these people because like the first part, the guys were just kind of ridiculous.
Well, that's kind of how like, this yeah. is. It just goes on and on.
Yeah. So I just can't.
I think the only normal people are Carol Baskin's dead husband's daughters. They seem pretty normal. Those are
go.
The only ones. I'm not kidding. And then
they're like in a lawsuit with Netflix now. Carol Baskin and his. Yeah.
Well, I thought was pretty clever. During the Dancing with the Stars, remember Carol Baskin was on Dancing with the Stars. The attorney rented ad space to run a commercial about what happened to Carol Baskin's ex-husband during her episode. I did not know that. I was like,
might as well do it. Gotta do it.
That's brutal.
No, I mean, there's something like even Homeland Security knew that he was in Costa Rica. Something like that. I mean, and Homeland Security was in 2002, I guess, started 2002. I don't know. Just ridiculousness of it. But otherwise, no, I've just been reading and trying to write the very last episode. That's it.
Yep.
And going everywhere, taking my kids everywhere.
Driver's license.
I'm telling you, I know. I never fully got why my mom is like, I can't wait till you get your driver's license.
But
amazing. Seriously, I cannot wait till my oldest one can get her driver's license.
It's amazing.
Because I drive everywhere now.
It's so
everywhere.
Nice. I can't tell you. It's just it's amazing.
I mean,
well,
I enjoy time in the car with the kids. Don't get me wrong. I really do. But it's just, yeah.
So that's it, Jen. Big thank you to Chris again. We're going to, you know.
Thanks, Chris.
Let you go. But I guess we have one more episode. Then we
two
have
more
a
episodes.
Whole bunch of episodes, right?
We have two more episodes.
Two more episodes, then a whole bunch of episodes. Then we get a little break.
Then we're off until the 13th of January, 2022.
Okay.
Oh, exciting.
It is exciting. But remember, Jen, until then, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. Happy Thanksgiving.
This crime, with its deceit and jealousy, is heavily laden with plenty of scandals.
Laden.
Dang it. I knew I was going to say that wrong. And I saw it ahead and I was like, okay, say it right. Laden.